So we are in our second lesson in Revelation. Last time we got through chapter 1. Today we're going to go through the seven churches. And as you remember, Yeshua last time told us what the symbols meant. So I'm going to pick it up in 1:17. When I saw him, I fell at his feet as though dead, but he laid his right hand on me, saying, "Fear not, for I am the first and the last and the living one. I died, and behold, I am alive forevermore. And I have the keys of death and Hades." We'll talk about keys in just a minute. "Write therefore the things that you have seen, the things that are and that are to take place after this. As for the mystery of the seven stars that you saw in my right hand and the seven golden lampstands, the seven stars are the angels of the seven churches, and the seven lampstands are the seven churches." I'm reading this book by Doug Van Doren called Rings of Revelation, and he regards stars in the book uniformly as a metaphor for heavenly beings. And I'm quite all right with that. And the idea that the church is a lampstand, and of course seven of them is a menorah, is that the church is intended to cast light into the world. So all of that works just fine. Now, seven churches. We have fairly recently done a study where we correlated the seven churches with the seven kingdom parables and the seven pastoral letters that Paul wrote. I'm not going to go through that again. You can look that up on my website if you want to listen to it. Doug Van Doren's scholarship, I think, is excellent. I don't always agree with his conclusions, but that's okay. But he laid them out as a chiasm, the seven churches, with one in the middle, obviously. So Ephesus corresponds to the parable of the sower, and it also corresponds to Paul's letter to the Ephesians. The word Ephesus means desirable. Smyrna corresponds to the parable of the weeds and the letter to the Thessalonians. Smyrna, the word is myrrh, channeling Chuck Missler now. Smyrna is obviously a church under persecution. Myrrh is a funereal spice which is used to anoint the dead, and in order to get it to release its fragrance, it has to be crushed. So that is Smyrna. Pergamum, that would correspond to the parable of the mustard seed and the letters to the Corinthians. And Pergamum means mixed marriage. Thyatira, which means sacrifice, corresponds to the parable of the yeast and Galatians. And then Sardis means escaping. It corresponds to the hidden treasure in the letter to the Romans. And then Philadelphia, of course, means brotherly love, and that corresponds to the parable of the pearl of great price and to the letter to the Philippians. And then Laodicea means rule by the laity, which means the common people rule, democracy, if you will. That corresponds to the parable of the dragnet and the book of Colossians. As I say, we went through that study over a period of several weeks in some detail. The point of doing that study is these are letters to seven churches. And the first letter in the parables, if you will, is Yeshua's letter. It's not really a missive, but it's his discussion of that church from a pre-cross position. And then the letters here in Revelation are letters from Christ to the various churches from a post-resurrection perspective. And then Paul's letters are letters to the churches from somebody on the ground with skin on that they know. And one of the things that you find is that the correlation among them is really very good. But it also forms a chiasm. And I'm going to channel Doug Van Doren a little bit here. And what he sees is Thyatira is the middle of the chiasm. So you'll notice that his characterization of Ephesus and the letter matches is it's unloving. The problem that the Ephesians have is they've lost their first love. go to the other end of the chiasm, which is Laodicea, and they don't have any passion. They're lukewarm. And then coming in, Smyrna is a church under persecution, and they remain faithful under persecution. Philadelphia is also faithful, and they have little power, which is to say they're not a mega church and they aren't politically influential, but they stay faithful. Then Pergamum is false doctrine, and we'll get to these as we go through them, and that corresponds to Sardis, which is dead and has no works. So if you have bad doctrine, you can wind up not having any works that are pleasing to God. And then, of course, Thyatira in the middle is immoral, idolatrous, pretty much the worst of the bunch. That's the chiasm. And I agree with the chiasm. I don't buy all of his conclusions, but as I say, his scholarship is excellent. And when he is analyzing the structure of the text and so forth, he's done some really good work. So I am shamelessly cribbing that. That's the layout of what's going on. With that, I will now swing back and let's start with keys, because Yeshua says he has the keys to death and Hades. Well, there are a number of passages about keys, and we'll see keys mentioned in one of the letters. So let's talk about keys for just a minute. The first mention of keys is in Isaiah 22:22. Pick it up at 19. Now what this is Shebna, one of the bureaucrats, if you will, has gotten too big for his britches. He has made himself a tomb, a very grand tomb. And that is not pleasing. So he gets fired from his job and it is given to Hilkiah. So pick it up at 19. I will thrust you from your office and you will be pulled down from your station. In that day, I will call my servant Eliakim, the son of Hilkiah, and I will clothe him with your robe and I will bind your sash on him and will commit your authority to his hand. And he shall be a father to the inhabitants of Jerusalem and to the house of Judah. And I will place on his shoulder the keys of the house of David. He shall open and none shall shut, and he shall shut and none shall open. What it's talking about here is Eliakim becomes essentially the chief of staff to the king. He gets to make decisions about a lot of stuff, which the chief of staff, of course, does. But one of the things that the keys represent is access. The chief of staff has access to the king. So when you want to talk to the king or the president or the CEO, you have to go through his chief of staff. And the chief of staff decides whether what you want to talk about or you are important enough to bother the king with. So it represents, in this case, access. And we'll see that when we get to one of the churches, this key of David gets mentioned again. So the next one is in Matthew. This is where Yeshua is talking to Peter. Matthew 16, verse 13. Now when Yeshua came to the district of Caesarea Philippi, he asked his disciples, "Who do people say that the Son of Man is?" And they said, "Some say John the Baptist, others say Elijah, and others Jeremiah or one of the prophets." He said to them, "But who do you say that I am?" Simon Peter replied, "You are the Christ, the Son of the living God." And Yeshua answered him, "Blessed are you, Simon Barjona, for flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but my Father who is in heaven. And I tell you, you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it. I will give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven, and whatever you bind on earth shall be bound in heaven, and whatever you loose on earth shall be loosed in heaven." The idea there is access. The binding and loosing, if you will, is a halakhic term, and it means if you guys agree that this is okay, it's okay. If you guys agree that this thing is forbidden, it's forbidden. I am giving you that key so that you can bind and loose, which is to say you can set halaha for the church. So the next one is in Luke, and this is where Yeshua is grumpy with lawyers. I'm in Luke 11:52. Woe to you, lawyers, for you have taken away the key of knowledge. You did not enter yourselves, and you hindered those who were entering. What he's talking about is, in that society, a lawyer is one who is charged with interpreting the Torah. So what he's saying is, you have hindered people from learning Torah the way it is supposed to be taught, and furthermore, you are not doing it yourselves. So it isn't even the case that you're shutting it up and keeping it all for yourself. You're shutting it up so nobody can get in, and you're not going in yourself. You are a dead end. And then the next one, of course, is where Yeshua talks about the keys to death in Hades. And then the next one will be the Church of Philadelphia, who has the key of David. Remember, we talked about the key of David back in the book of Isaiah, where we started with. So the last one is you have a strong angel, one of the trumpeters. I'm in Revelation 9. And the fifth angel blew his trumpet, and I saw a star fallen from heaven to earth. He was given the key to the shaft of the bottomless pit. This is a heavenly messenger coming down with a key to the bottomless pit. And what he will do with that key is he will open the bottomless pit and release the demons that are trapped there for a while. So that's keys. And the basic metaphor for keys is access. If you have keys, you have access, and you can either grant access or deny access, depending. So now let's go to chapter 2 in Revelation. Let's start with the church at Ephesus. To the angel of the church at Ephesus write, the words of him who holds the seven stars in his right hand, who walks among the seven golden lampstands. Holding the seven stars in his right hand, each star represents a heavenly being who has charge or watch over each church. And what he's saying is they all work for me. And walks among the seven golden lampstands. So what he's saying is not only do I have charge of the heavenly beings that are watching you, I am also able to walk among you. I know your works, your toil and your patient endurance, and how you cannot bear with those who are evil, but have tested those who call themselves apostles and are not, and found them to be false. I know you are enduring patiently and bearing up for my name's sake, and you have not grown weary. But I have this against you. You have abandoned the love you had at first. Remember, therefore, from where you have fallen, repent and do the works you did at first. If not, I will come to you and remove your lampstand from its place, unless you repent. Yet this you have, you hate the works of the Nicolaitans, which I also hate. He who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. To the one who conquers, I will grant to eat of the tree of life, which is in the paradise of God. First off, Ephesus is the biggest city of the seven. It is a major trade center. It figures prominently in the book of Acts. Paul pastors the church there for a while. John pastors the church there for a while. And I believe Timothy pastors a church there for a while. So it's a major center of early Christendom. They have got apostles, if you will, coming and going. Because they have this constant refreshing, if you will, of apostles, their understanding of doctrine is really good. That's what they're good at. They know the Torah, they know the gospel, they know how they relate, they're squared away. And remember, one of the things that you find in, for example, the book of Galatians, where Paul has gone to Galatia and has taught and converted a bunch of people, and then he's left. He is followed up by a bunch of Judaizers who are trying to tell the Galatians that, well, the only way you can be saved is if you get circumcised. So the letter that he's writing is telling the converts in Galatia that these people who have followed me are wrong. They are giving you bad doctrine. Well, Ephesus I am sure, dealt with the same kinds of thing, but Ephesus is able to look at these guys and say, you're full of cornflakes, and send them on their way, whereas the Galatians are troubled by it. So the ability to test those who call themselves apostles and find them false is a mark of their doctrinal purity. And the question becomes, when you say you've abandoned the love you had at first, who was that love for? Lots of your commentaries will say, well, they've lost the love of Christ. And perhaps they have, I don't know. But the other perspective is, one of the things that happens with people who are intellectually, doctrinally pure is they tend to get cold. They become very analytic, not very warm at all, and they look at everybody with sort of a suspicious look on their face. Reading Doug Wilson up in Idaho is talking about communion. And he makes this big deal about who can come to the Lord's table. And what he says is, the only way you're going to get the gospel is to come to church. So a church has to have a wide open, welcoming door. But if you are not truly regenerated, you don't come to the table. So what a church needs is a wide open, welcoming door and a set of bouncers in front of the communion table. That's how I see Ephesus. They're sort of looking at everybody suspiciously and saying, all right, are you properly vetted, baptized, regenerated, whatever the Calvinist words for all that are, or are you somebody that we need to be suspicious of? So I regard Ephesus in sort of the same spirit as the bouncers that Doug Wilson says that a proper church ought to, and he's not talking about literal bouncers, but that's the metaphor he's using. People who aren't properly vetted by the church do not come to the table. Ephesus' strong point is intellectual clarity and being able to test somebody who comes by with a 3-day pass and a briefcase, is preaching to see if it is, in fact, true, or if this guy is a false apostle, and if he is, they boot him. But the love that they have lost, I am suggesting, is for each other. And the reason I say that is down in verse 4, but I have this against you, that you have abandoned the love you had at first. Remember from where you have fallen, repent, and do the works you did at first. And the problem appears to be works, which is to say, care for each other and care for the community. That would be my guess, the symptom of them having lost the first love, is they have become cold and they have stopped doing things in the community. And to the one who conquers, I will grant to eat of the tree of life, which is in the paradise of God. By the way, the other end of that chiasm is in Revelation 21, verse 5. And he who was seated on the throne said, behold, I am making all things new. That's obviously Yeshua. Also he said, write this down, for these words are trustworthy and true. And he said to me, it is done. I am the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. To the thirsty I will give from the spring of the water of life without payment. The one who conquers will have his heritage, and I will be his God, and he will be my son. All of these letters in Revelation 2 and 3 contain promises to the one who conquers. Revelation 21 is where that promise gets fulfilled. Both ends of a very large chiasm. I showed that chiasm last time. Doug Van Doren's take on that is they're unloving, and I completely agree with that. So the church at Smyrna, and to the angel of the church at Smyrna, write, the words of the first and the last who died and came alive. I know your tribulation and your poverty, but you are rich, and the slander of those who say that they are Jews and are not, but are a synagogue of Satan. Do not fear what you are about to suffer. Behold, the devil is about to throw some of you into prison that you may be tested. And for 10 days you will have tribulation. Be faithful unto death, and I will give you the crown of life. He who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. The one who conquers will not be hurt by the second death. Notice that both Smyrna and Philadelphia are harassed by the synagogue of Satan. Smyrna is obviously a church under persecution. He has told them, hang on, do not give up your faith. It may result in physical death, but if you hang on to the end, you will get a crown of life and you will not be hurt by the second death. And as I said earlier, the word Smyrna comes from myrrh, and myrrh, in order to be useful, has to be crushed. So the church of Pergamum. Pergamum means mixed marriage. And to the angel of the church at Pergamum write, the words of him who has a sharp two-edged sword. I know where you dwell, where Satan's throne is. Yet you hold fast my name and do not deny my faith. Even the days of Antipas, my faithful witness, who was killed among you, where Satan dwells. So they live at the local headquarters of Satan. I'm not sure it's a branch office or the world headquarters, but that's where they are. Verse 14, but I have a few things against you. You have some there who hold the teaching of Balaam, who taught Balak to put a stumbling block before the sons of Israel, so that they might eat food sacrificed to idols and practice sexual immorality. So also you have some who hold the teaching of the Nicolaitans. Therefore repent. If not, I will come to you soon and war against you with the sword of my mouth. Notice it started off with a sharp two-edged sword, and it ends with him warring against him with the sword of his mouth. He who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. To the one who conquers, I will give some of the hidden manna, and I will give him a white stone with a new name written on the stone that no one knows except the one who receives it. Several things. Nicolaitans. Nobody's quite sure what the Nicolaitans were. The literal word combination of two Greek words, rule over the common people, or the laity, as in churches have clergy and laity. So Nicolaitans would be someone who rules over the laity. God does not like that. Christ does not like that. Having people in that church who hold to that teaching is a problem. Similarly, they have the doctrine of Balaam, and you, of course, all remember the story of Balaam. Balak is a Moabite. He hires Balaam to come and curse Israel. Balaam is unable to curse Israel, but there's still a fee on the table. So after his failure to curse, he goes and he tells them that the way to get these people is to get them to curse themselves. And the way you do that is you flood the place with good-looking babes who are idol worshipers. The men of Israel will get all hot and bothered about these good-looking women, and in that process, they will eat food sacrificed to idols, and they will do idol worship. And that will cause God to deal with them for you. That's the doctrine of Balaam. Back in verse 14 now. But I have a few things against you. You have some who hold to the teaching of Balaam, who taught Balak to put a stumbling block before the sons of Israel, so that they might eat food sacrificed to idols and practice sexual immorality. And that, of course, is exactly what they did. And the point of this church is you have got people in there who are doing that stuff. They're eating food sacrificed to idols and they're being sexually immoral. That's where we get Pergamum, which is mixed marriage. So the church at Pergamum is nominally Christian, but they have brought a lot of their pagan ways into the church and have not left them at the door. That's what's going on. And then, of course, once that comes in, it spreads because they're having a lot of fun. Why don't we do that? That's one of the things that has happened to the church over 2,000 years. Is you have all sorts of pagan customs that have come into the church, like Christmas trees and Easter bunnies and maypoles. All of those things come from paganism, and they have infiltrated the church, and gee, Christmas is really fun. And so Christmas spreads. And that's what he's talking about here in the letter to the church at Pergamum. And now down to verse 17. He who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. To the one who conquers, I will give some of the hidden manna, and I will give him a white stone with a new name written on the stone that no one knows except the one who receives it. The hidden manna is the manna that is in a pot in the Ark of the Covenant. And then this white stone, that has two meanings. One of the ways that secret societies have always voted is you have a ceramic jar, and everybody has a white stone and a black stone, or a white marble and a black marble, white and black. And if you agree, you put a white stone in there. If you disagree, you put a black stone in there. So the white stone indicates approval. And then the name written on it that no one knows except the one who receives it. In this culture, if you had the power to name someone, you had power over it. The obvious example, of course, is children. Parents name their children. And in fact, in this culture, fathers had power over their children as long as the father was alive. So the two things there, the white stone means I approve you, and the name that no one knows except you means that you are free. No one has dominion over you. Questions about Pergamum? So Pergamum, according to Van Dorn, has false doctrine. So the next one is going to be Thyatira. And to the angel of the church at Thyatira, write, the words of the Son of God, who has eyes like a flame of fire and whose feet are like burnished bronze. In other words, I'm looking at you and I am not happy. Eyes are flaming and bronze is the metal that can withstand heat. Altars are made out of bronze. They are not made out of silver or gold. So the idea that he's coming on feet of bronze with fire in his eyes indicates he's not pleased. Verse 19, I know your works, your love and faith and service and patient endurance, and that your latter works exceed the first. But, by the way, this is the longest letter. It's in the middle of the chiasm, and it hits everything. Virtually everything that we've talked about so far gets mentioned in here. So I know your works, your love and faith and service and patient endurance, and that your latter works exceed the first. But I have this against you, that you tolerate that woman Jezebel, who calls herself a prophetess and is teaching and seducing my servants to practice sexual immorality and to eat food sacrificed to idols. So the first thing is she calls herself a prophetess. The thing about Ephesus that was good is they were able to sort these people out. Thyatira can't. So she's in there and is speaking in the name of God as a prophet. She is telling them to practice sexual immorality and eat food sacrificed to idols. There have been sects of Christianity over the years where sexually anything goes, and it was part of their belief, if you will, that they were Christians following the gospel, and anything you want to do is just fine. Same with food sacrificed to idols. Verse 21, I gave her time to repent, but she refuses to repent of her sexual immorality. The idea here is Yeshua gave her the opportunity to repent, and she would not. That's what is called other places in the Bible as hard forehead. She isn't listening. I gave her time to repent, but she refuses to repent of her sexual immorality. Behold, I will throw her into a sick bed, and those who commit adultery with her I will throw into great tribulation unless they repent of her works. And I will strike her children dead, and all the churches will know that I am he who searches mind and heart and will give to each of you according to your works. Sickbed, that is a reference of a woman in her menses. And of course in the Torah, cohabiting during a time of the menses is forbidden. So the idea of throwing her into her sickbed, she is going to be, to anybody who has anything to do with her, as if she were in her menses. That's the metaphor. Regardless of where she is actually physically, as far as God is concerned, anybody who messes with her is as if he were messing with a woman in her menses. That's what the metaphor is. Furthermore, any children that are begotten of this unclean union are also going to be destroyed. 23 and a half, I am the one who searches mind and heart, and I will give to each of you according to your works. And of course, we know at the great white throne, books are open and people are judged according to their works. However, anybody who follows this prophetess and her doctrine is going to have some works that he does not want to be judged for. 24. But to the rest of you in Thyatira, who do not hold this teaching, and who have not learned what some call the deep things of Satan, to you I say, I do not lay on you any other burden. I have no idea what the deep things of Satan are, and quite frankly, it's not something I want to learn. But the point is, this whole church is corrupt. And so anybody in this church who is able to resist the social pressure of a corrupt church, as far as Christ is concerned, that's all I can ask of you. Only hold fast to what you have until I come. And the one who conquers and who keeps my works until the end, to him I will give authority over the nations. And he will rule them with a rod of iron, as when earthen pots are broken in pieces, even as I myself have received authority from my Father. This ruling with a rod of iron takes you back to Psalm 2. And you remember in Psalm 2 that God is saying to his Son that I will put the nations under your feet and you will rule them with a rod of iron. So it's a metaphor that indicates strict rulership, if you will. Verse 28, and I will give him the morning star. He who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. Let's stop, and that'll give us a run at chapter 3 next time. This is the beginning of a long chiasm, and notice that every one of the churches, there is a promise to the one who conquers. And then at the end, in Revelation 21, the one who conquers will have his heritage, and I will be his God, and he will be my son. But as for the cowardly, the faithless, the detestable, as for murderers, the sexually immoral, sorcerers, idolaters, and all liars, their portion will be in the lake that burns with fire and sulfur, which is the second death. One of the things that's promised to Smyrna is that the second death will have no power over them. So the second death, if you will, is then mentioned in Revelation 21, as is the culmination of all the things that are promised to the ones who conquer. All of these letters are addressed to the angel of the church. What are the angels? And there are several opinions on that. Opinion number one is that they are the stars, if you will, that Yeshua is holding in his hand, which means that they're heavenly beings. Opinion number two is these represent the pastors of those various churches. And I don't know, but one of the things to be aware of is this whole book of Revelation is a letter. It will be circulated among those seven churches and read out loud. The letters, if you will, are to all of the physical churches that it is being sent to. It will be circulated around. It will be read out loud. And there will be a couple of things going on. One, of course, is everybody's ears are going to perk up when they talk about their church. And so they'll hear what Yeshua has to say about their church. There's a couple of other perspectives that I might mention as we're here. My perspective on these are seven literal, actual churches. Each one of these churches has the strengths and weaknesses that Yeshua is talking about. There are people who view this as being stages in the church age. You first off have Ephesus, which is the apostolic church when the apostles were still alive. Then you have Smyrna, which is the church under persecution by the Romans. Then you have Pergamum, as paganism starts to come in. Then you have Thyatira, which is the Catholic church. Then you have Sardis, which is the Reformation. And finally, you have Laodicea, which is where we are now, where nobody gives a rat. If it wasn't believable, nobody would believe it. You can look at the Catholic Church at the way they were at the time of the Reformation, totally corrupt. And the Reformation was a reaction to that. But the Reformation didn't go far enough. So you didn't wind up in Philadelphia, you wind up with the dead church. That's the church that is mired in reading the gospel like a law book, which is one of the things that I disagree with in Calvinism. Calvin was a lawyer, and he reads the Bible like a law document. And I don't believe that's how it's intended to be read. Not to say that he's dumb or anything like that. He's certainly not. I just don't agree with him. So the idea that this represents seven stages of the church from the time of Christ's resurrection until the time of his return is not stupid, but it's also seven literal churches that existed then that have this problem, because Yeshua is writing to that church and he's talking about that church, and if what he was saying didn't match what was going on in the church, the people hearing the letter would say, huh? What are you talking about? Do with that as seems good to you. It's a very common and popular perspective on these letters.